You guys, you're not in the order that you are on my
list.
You were told to sit here.
Okay. if I introduce you as Jill. Okay, good evening. Hi, everyone. My name's Kathy English. I'm the co-chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation Programming Committee, and I'm very happy to welcome you to our first program of the 2014 Fall Series. We're very excited about what we've got planned for this fall and tonight's session on native advertising, and we're very happy to see you here. Before I introduce our panel, I'd like to thank our exclusive JTalk sponsor, BMO Financial Group, for your outstanding ongoing support of this series. We just couldn't do it without BMO Financial, and we're very grateful. I'd also like to give a shout out of thanks to CJF Executive Director Natalie Turvey and her staff of Wendy Kahn and Josh Gerfinkel. They do all the heavy lifting to make these events happen, so thank you. Okay, our panel. They're not in the order of my list, so I'm going to have to just rejig here. Okay, to my immediate right is Scott White. Scott is the Vice President of Content Strategy and Business Development for Post Media Network. Scott leads the development of content strategies for native advertising and branded content across all platforms and explores new partnerships and opportunities. As many of you likely know, Scott was most recently editor-in-chief of the Canadian Press, where for the last 15 years he had the challenge, sometimes agonizing challenge, of seeing the organization transform from a print organization to a multimedia organization. Besides Scott, we have Jill Bora. Jill is the executive editor at the Globe and Mail. In addition to being responsible for strategic direction and development of print and digital products, she serves as editorial manager of the Globe's custom content group, including advertiser-sponsored editorial content and integration of native advertising. Prior to this role, Jill was the Globe's managing editor, its features editor, and its life editor. I think the travel editor, too, somewhere along there. Catherine Bradbury is the executive director of content development at Star Media Group. Catherine will also be taking on a new role as Vice President and Editor-in-Chief of Metro English Canada, beginning in just a couple weeks. Catherine joined Star Media Group in 2011 and launched Star Content Studios. She's also held senior leadership roles at Rogers Publishing and, of course, the Globe and Mail as well. Our moderator tonight, who is going to keep this crew under control, is Ivor Shapiro. Ivor is the chair of the School of Journalism and associate professor at Ryerson University. Ivor teaches ethics and feature reporting, and conducts research into aspects of ethics and excellence in journalism. He is the formidable chair of the Ethics Advisory Committee of the Canadian Association of Journalism, and he was the founding editor of the Canadian Journalism Project, which most of you know as JSource. Before moving into academia, Professor Shapiro had a long time distinguished career in the Canadian magazine publishing industry. And I will turn it over to Ivor Shapiro.
Thank you, Kathy. Catherine and I noticed as you were speaking that you did slip in some branded content, and I guess that makes this whole evening native advertising. Our three distinguished speakers, all in management positions at three of Canada's large news organizations, are as aware as anyone in the room that while they don't necessarily agree with one another about everything to do with our subject matter, there are important perspectives missing from this panel as it has been assembled. So we, in order to avoid any threat of singing from the same hymn book, we are going to do two things to ensure that the discussion today, this evening, covers diverse ground and perspectives. The first is that each of the three speakers is going to answer just two questions from me at the top of the show, and they're going to keep those introductory remarks brief. so that most of our time together can be spent in engagement with you, who used to be called audiences, I suppose. questions that are both complicated and controversial need a number of perspectives. So we're relying on you to bring a variety of perspectives and experience to bear on this evening's conversation. So in other words, get your questions ready, your comments ready. You will have a chance to voice them. And if you don't, this could be a kind of boring and short evening. To kick off, the second thing we're going to do to ensure a range of perspective is that to kick off our discussion in a suitably contrarian way for a bunch of journalists, we'll be joined by someone who has a distinctly, a decidedly different perspective on the matter under discussion. So please welcome, not at all live from New York, or at least not live from a YouTube server somewhere near you, or at least somewhere near the New Mexico desert, our guest, John Oliver.
Print publications have struggled to attract advertisers, partly because traditional banner ads are so ineffective that one study found we only intentionally click on them less than 0.2% of the time, which actually sounds about right. Because did you know that if you ever actually click on a banner ad, you literally get taken to a page that reads, "Hey, is everything okay? I'm presuming you passed out and hit your head on the keyboard. I'm calling an ambulance right now." The publishing industry, though, has responded to this crisis by finding a new way to appeal to advertisers.
Native advertising is basically saying to corporations that want to advertise, we will camouflage your ads to make them look like news stories. That's essentially it.
That's essentially it. Are you saying that to sum up your point on native advertising, or are you describing independent journalism? That's essentially it. It's over. We're done here. Even if you've not heard the term native advertising before, you have probably been subjected to it by now. It's when a piece of ostensibly normal content is stamped with tiny disclaimers like this and this, and then contains messages that are often clear endorsements. And if you'll excuse me, I'll just take a break from making this point by enjoying the refreshing taste of Mountain Dew Code Red. And then it's at this point that you usually realize, oh, this isn't the thing that I was looking for. You're just advertising the most disgusting drink ever manufactured. although, I will say it does undeniably taste of red. Native advertising, though, has been so lucrative for new media organizations that they've basically built their entire business model around it.
100% of our revenue comes from branded content. So we have a lot of partners who are marketers and major brands. We work with 76 of the top 100 brands now.
That's the CEO of BuzzFeed, Jonah Peretti. And his face is like BuzzFeed itself. Successful, appealing, and yet somehow you want to punch it. BuzzFeed has created masterpieces of native advertising, such as 10 life-changing ways to make your day more efficient, sponsored by GE, and 9 ways cleaning has become smarter, sponsored by Swiffer, and 11 sea creatures who deserve to die, sponsored by BP. Now, that last one is a joke, but it's not significantly different from the previous two. Full disclosure, HBO did pay for lists to promote this show around the time that we began, very cleverly realizing we'd better promote this show, no one is going to give a shit about it. But the success of this practice has clearly impressed old media such as Time Inc., whose CEO recently created a native advertising team. And he also doesn't see why that might be an issue.
As long as it's clearly marked, as long as the consumer knows the difference between what's editorial and what's native, I don't see any problem with it at all.
Yeah, but it is a problem, though, because the consumer cannot tell the difference. A recent study showed that less than half of visitors to a news site could distinguish native advertising from actual news. And of course they can't, because it's supposed to blend in. You're like a camouflage manufacturer saying, only an idiot could not tell the difference between that man and foliage. I mean, look, the camouflage clearly states not foliage on the collar. It's clear. And besides, I'm sure the deer knows the difference between the two things. Deers are so smart. You have to respect deer. And if you are wondering how he reconciles this with the line between church and state, well, funny story.
Quite frankly, I've changed church and state, as you know. We took that away and we said the editors are going to now be working for the business side of the equation. Quite frankly, I think they're happier. They're more excited about it because no longer are we asking ourselves the question, are we violating church and state, whatever that was.
Whatever that was. That's like a surgeon saying, hey, I found this squishy thing in there, all bloody and gross, so I removed it, whatever that was. That was the heart. That was what made the whole thing work. You needed that.
So, Scott White, as you take your seat, you've been in journalism all your life, you've run Canada's National Wire Service, and now in your new role at Postmedia with responsibility for native content, are you busy ripping the heart out of the news business? And by the way, what exactly is all this stuff that's called native content? From your point of view, what is it anyway?
I'll get to that in a minute. So it's a great piece, and all of us, I bet, were, the night that ran our inbox the next morning, there was like 50,000 everybody we work with sent this to us. You know, the thing that's not stated at all here is that our business models for all of us, if we want to have independent journalism, we need to find a way to pay for it. And you could argue that any kind of sponsorship advertising affects the credibility, but we have standards in place, and we'll talk a lot about that later tonight. So I'm absolutely not ripping the heart out of it. Quite honestly, the reason I got into this was because I was concerned that as an industry, we're going to go away. We are. And unless we find a way to pay for what we do. And I think this is an important part. We'll talk about the need for it to have transparency and that necessary. I completely disagree with the Times CEO. They're absolutely church and state, the firewall. As a matter of fact, when Lou Clancy hired me for this position, it was to make sure that there was a firewall, that there was a single point of contact between the newsrooms and the sales staff. I have a foot in each part of it. And so, and I know that it's the same at the other places. So I would argue, and I will argue, that it's a really important part to maintain the integrity. So what is native advertising? And that's a great question because there's not a single standard definition. How we describe it at Postmedia, very simply, is native content, is what we would call it, is content that we produce for advertisers. That's the very simplest way to describe it. We also do advertorial. You know, all of us still do advertorial, where the advertiser gives you content and could be camera ready or whatever, but you're not shaping it and forming it in a way that is native, that is sort of fits within the eyeballs. You're trying to attract the type of reader that fits, and I think fit is a really important part of whether this is going to be successful or not. There are some places, everybody knows the story of Atlantic and Scientology, that was not a good fit for the Atlantic. So the fit is really necessary, and we'll talk a lot more about it, but I think that it's not ripping the heart out, it's helping keep the body alive.
Thank you. Jill Bora, during the Globe's recent contract negotiations, JSource published a leaked memo, as we all know, from Globe management that defined three types of native advertising: custom content, directed editorial, and advertorial, and then indicated different ways in which the company expects newsroom staff to participate in the production of this type of material. Now, that was a negotiating position. We know things move on. But how does the Globe and Mail currently see things? Are those three categories still active? And what difference do they make in terms of who decides what in content?
Yeah, it's slightly different from what you said. It's actually custom content, advertorial, and branded content. Mm-hmm. Native sort of an offshoot of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to complicate the matter. I do think there's a lot of confusion, not only within our own organizations about all these different things, but also across the industry. I don't think we've done a very good job of coming up with like common language to talk about the same things. So we have what we call custom content is editorial. So it's produced by a custom content group of journalists within our newsroom, sometimes by freelancers, sometimes by other journalists in the newsroom, and it's editorial. So an advertiser will buy like a sponsorship, like an adjacency to that content, but they don't read the content, see the content, influence the content in any way. So that's custom content. We've been doing that for years. Actually, we've been producing special reports of that nature since I think the 70s or something, but definitely for the past 10 years or so, that's been a common thing. Advertorial, I think, is the more typical thing that Scott referred to that we all know. The advertiser has full control over what's in there. It's often very promotional for their own purposes. That in at the Globe, the newsroom has nothing to do with that whatsoever, not even our custom content group. So that's produced by outside contractors through the advertising department. It's labeled everywhere it appears. There's a little note on it that says it's produced by advertising, and it looks different from the editorial content. Branded content is sort of a new area for us in the last 4 or 5 years, where a brand will come to us because we're experts in content creation and storytelling, and we'll create magazines or digital platforms for them, but it doesn't actually appear on our in our pages or on our platform. We're more just sort of a content production company in that sense. Sometimes we will distribute those magazines in the Globe, but we distribute lots of different magazines in the Globe, but we don't produce. And then native is the new thing. And for us, we use that term just strictly to refer to digital, where it is advertiser content, but it is overseen by managers, not newsroom staff, not anybody in the union. And outsourced to freelancers. So we create content, but instead of appearing from an ad unit, it actually is within the flow of the editorial. So it'll be in a main spot on our site. And we're actually pretty happy with how we've come to label that. So it's shaded, it's labeled sponsored content. When you get to the article page, it looks different. And it's called sponsored content. It says brought to you by whoever and content created by that advertiser. And then we write a note that says this was created by the advertising department and the editorial department had nothing to do with it. So it's not simple. I was hoping to do a very simple thing, but it's actually, there's a few branches to it, and it's important to kind of understand the differences. And I think people have been using that word advertorial to refer to all kinds of different things that really are quite, they have some important nuanced differences.
Yeah, and you know, I think we should say that we did notice that even whoever wrote the marketing copy for this event seemed to group it all under the heading of advertorial. So there's clearly some lack of understanding of the various nuances. And I suppose, Catherine Bradbury, you're going to tell us that you guys define things in a completely different way. And please do. But while you're doing that, please tell us, in your thinking about what, for want of a better word, we're going to say native, I suppose, even though the word doesn't work. But in thinking about this type of material, what does the Star do about that church-state firewall? Does that firewall still exist? Is it still feasible? What do you think?
You know, we also have similar definitions or slightly different definitions. But in my own mind, and what I talk about with the people I work with at the Star, is that fundamentally, there are two kinds of content in a media organization. One is commercial content, and one is journalism. So commercial content exists in media because somebody has paid for it to exist. And it can exist in all the different kinds of forms we're talking about, branded, directed, advertorial. Journalism is unfettered, or at least that's what we aspire to. Journalism is something that is there because we seek truth and justice, and you know, that's why a lot of people get into journalism in the first place. At the end of that video, Oliver actually says that, I'll quote, a free press can't be free and independent if no one is willing to pay for it. And I think that that's, it's not the first time we've been in this crisis, but it is a crisis that we're in right now. Less and less readers want to pay for us, less and less advertisers want to simply follow the same old model of put an ad beside a piece of journalism. So I think this kind of commercial content is one way that everybody is looking at to see if it's a model that works, or at least if it's a model that leads us to something that does work. I do think that, you know, talking about church and state, we have always been in the mashup of where great advertising and great journalism meet. That's what the media is. We've always been struggling in that intersection and trying to figure out what is the church, what is the state, what are the lines. You know, I've been reading a book about the New York Times set in the 60s, and in the women's section was fueled by huge advertising dollars from all of the women's department stores, you know, on Fifth Avenue, Bergdorf's and Barney's and Saks. And the managers would go around with a ruler, and if the column inches on a particular store were smaller than the size of the ad, people would write a few more column inches. Meanwhile, in the same organization, a few floors away, the newsroom of the New York Times was toppling governments. They were doing the Pentagon Papers. They were doing the Watergate. So, you know, I think both kinds of content can exist within an organization. And I think one of our challenges is to be respectful of both of them and figure out together where the lines need to be.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, just for the sake of convenience, can we use a word for the rest of the evening that we're all comfortable with that is generic to embrace all of this material? Or, I think certainly we should put advertorial aside as a different kind of thing altogether. Is the word native suffice? Will that word suffice for us for convenience? No. Okay. What word would you suggest we use for the rest of the evening to discuss what?
Well,
we're
I would say paid content or paid commercial content. But
yeah. I can live with that.
Okay. Okay. Paid content it is. Very good. Okay, thank you. So just a word to you guys out there. I said I'd be asking two rounds of questions. We're halfway through. And once we're done, we'll be turning over to you. So there is a microphone back there that I'm pointing at, and there are two ways to that microphone. And we would ask that everybody who wants to engage in the conversation go to the microphone and form an orderly line and not punch anybody. There are two ways to get there. One is around this pillar here from the front, and the other is along the aisle back there that is a little bit wider. So please feel free to start thinking about your questions and indeed take your place in line as we go into round two, which starts with Catherine. Catherine, according to the New York Times, this is VP for advertising, New York Times paid posts may get more readers and engage them for longer than do editorial stories. That's according to a Wall Street Journal blogger. I find myself wondering, Catherine, how happy you would be to hear that Toronto Star readers are more attentive to paid commercial content than to independently produced news stories. Isn't the whole enterprise of native or paid content that looks like or is somehow presented to readers in the way that journalism is presented, isn't that whole kind of thing by nature an act of deception? Is there any point in doing it at all unless we're trying to trick our audiences into reading this material or viewing this material or clicking on this material?
You know, woohoo for paid posts. That's amazing. I think the New York Times is doing paid posts brilliantly, and I think it's also doing it without any trickery or deception. I know that Oliver, if anyone's watched the full clip, at one point pokes fun at something they did around women in prison that's actually a paid post from Netflix. But it says paid posts at the top, and it says brought to you by Netflix. It couldn't be clearer. bravo for them if more people are reading it. I guess they're doing a really good job. And I think that's one of the things that commercial content or paid content has learned from journalism, and it's the reason why journalists such as ourselves are involved in it, is you know, it has to be good if it's going to, if anyone's going to pay attention to it or read it. It has to have the same, it isn't journalism, but it has to have the same bar as journalism in terms of great reporting, great storytelling, great presentation. Otherwise, no one's going to spend any time with it, and what's the point in having it? Did that answer your question, or did I veer off into a whole other thing?
I think I'll let our audience decide if you answered the question. If someone feels you didn't, I hope they'll take a place on the microphone. Jill Bora.
Well, I was just going to, add to what Catherine said. I think implicit in that statement is something, your statement, is that it's almost an, not an insult to readers, but you know, a lot of times it's said, you know, it's content, put content out there and let the readers decide, as long as you are not deceiving them and as long as you are not tricking them. So I don't think just because somebody clicked on something, it necessarily means there was trickery or that it was subpar. I don't know if anyone's read the Orange is the New Black piece that the New York Times did, but it's a very interesting multimedia execution that actually David Carr wrote in one of his columns, and he's not easy to please. He wrote, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, wow, all branded, brand-sponsored content does not suck. So that's sort of high praise from him. So, you know, there are ways to produce content. That piece didn't mention Netflix, it didn't mention the show, it didn't mention anything. It was just about women in prison. So I think that there's a high bar there for us to produce content that people actually want to look at. And now that it's digital, you can tell if people are looking at it or not. So if we fall down on that, if the brands fall down on that, then they lose and we lose too. So.
Yeah, I have to say, as a former managing editor of a women's magazine in Canada, I have no idea what you guys are talking about. Whether you like it or not, said a recent post on the Nieman Lab site, Jill, concluded this way, and I think you've seen it. Whether you like it or not, native advertising is now inside the big news tent. Maybe it's just a new iteration on advertorials. Maybe it's a scurrilous devaluation of journalism. Either way, it's here and at the highest levels of the business. What journalists, he says, can do is push for clear labeling, which was what you were talking about a moment ago. Journalists can push for clear labeling, shame those who fall short, and hope that the business sides of their outlets won't turn their brands into a non-renewable resource. So your response to that idea, and tell us more about the labeling rules that the Globe has, about what you do label and what you don't label under the various headings that you gave us the previous.
So anything that is advertiser content, advertiser approved or influenced content, so advertorial, and the native content is labeled. It's always been labeled. We've never had any intention to deceive our readers, but we do acknowledge that that labeling has been fairly inconsistent. And as these things kind of are iterative over the years, we haven't always used the same standards or the same conventions uniformly. And it's interesting, the native thing came up because we were sort of starting with a brand new proposition. And we looked at it long and hard, and I actually think we came to some very good kind of best practice for the industry rules for what we do with native.
What the heck is native?
Native.
I don't understand.
Can you listen to my explanation? So for us, native is when we create advertiser content on our site, but it appears you can get to it from clicking on it within the editorial flow.
It's embedded content.
It's embedded content as opposed to clicking on an ad unit that has some sort of.
It's the stuff you guys have on your mobile app. Like you have it regularly, right? With the yellow box and.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not always clear who it's from because it's not fully labeled, but it is there.
Yeah. No. So well, we say when you click on the box, when you click on an article, it says who sponsored it and who created the content. Now I've lost track of what we were talking about. Oh, labeling. So we just recently, we went back thinking of that and we sort of thought, let's apply that same standard to print so that everything we do is labeled exactly the same way, sponsored content. It's the same in print. It's the same size on every print execution that we do, and it matches everything we're doing in digital. So You know, we haven't been consistent about it, and that's just for the advertorial stuff I'm talking about, and native.
I think it would be fantastic if there was actually an industry standard on labeling and the disclaimer, whatever you want to call it, because the last thing that any of us want is that we're competing on lack of transparency. Hey, come to us because we are less transparent than those guys. So if there was an industry standard and it was the same rules, then you're just competing on the things you compete on. How do you do the best storytelling? You know, how imaginative are you? And I think the public would feel better, and I think it would, and I actually think eventually it's gonna go there. It will eventually get there, but both Catherine and you're right, because, you know, Jill has said this is a thing that has evolved, and I think all of us have made mistakes in the past. And as it becomes a more mature business, you know, we're trying to get it right.
So one follow-up on the labeling question. Jill, do you label all the categories you talked about? Do you label custom content?
We do not label custom content because it is editorial. So the advertiser has no influence on the content. They don't read it. They don't see it. They don't change it. They don't get mentioned in it. And so it's editorial. We don't really see it as different from, say, you know, it's the Olympics, and we go out to advertisers and say, look at all the cool things we're doing around the Olympics. They want to take out an ad next to that, so the bank runs their ad with their Go Athletes Olympic message. You know, it becomes complicated. We just don't see it as the same thing.
So we do. If there's a single advertiser around a series, and that we have gone, so newsrooms are stretched, we say, hey, we've got this great idea for a series. We need some extra revenue, and we can get someone like a GE to sponsor. And GE's sponsored, I think, sort of innovative series with all of us. In our mind, if the public has a question about that, so if there's a single advertiser, we will put a disclaimer at the bottom. We do that now, yeah.
Well, I think that just makes sense. What's wrong with saying brought to you by? You know, Jerry Seinfeld did comedians in cars with coffee, and now it's brought to you by Acura, if it's still going.
Yeah.
You know, brought to you by in the 50s was, you saw terrific content brought to you by GE or Exxon or, so I do think it's a kind of deception to say because the advertiser had no control over the copy and was hands off, that therefore we don't reveal that the copy is there because they requested something as vague as innovation. And right. I'm not saying it's just the Globe, but I think a brought to you by that makes it clear to people that in fact they didn't have any control of the editorial.
But then
content.
Do you put brought to you by, because we have all kinds of advertisers who might advertise beside a specific or a columnist because they like that content, or they might advertise next to the home and design stuff because they want to be right in the home and design stuff because that's where they want to be affiliated with. So it just gets complicated that you're going to have all these little brought to you buys all over your product.
The columnist exists and the advertiser chooses adjacency, which is the old model, that we all understood and have worked in for years and years. It's different for the advertiser to choose the subject and to only advertise within a section if it's the subject that they've chosen to participate around.
I'm looking out there and I'm seeing a lot of furrowed brows. That microphone is brought to you by the Canadian Journalism Foundation. go and express your furrowed brows there while I ask Scott White one last question before we go to audience. This one's from FT Magazine, an article by Andrew Edgecliffe Johnson. The Wall Street Journal's newsroom, he says, is not involved in sponsored content, but the journal's commercial team tells advertisers it can deploy sophisticated storytelling techniques in order to help brands create content-driven connections with audiences. Now, that theme, I think, picks up on something that I think all of you have in some way expressed, that, you know, we know how to tell stories in our place, and we can tell it better than the competition. But my question is, the writer comments, he comments, for some reporters and editors, this idea of the news organization telling stories for brands and telling stories independently, This idea, he says, is tantamount to media being complicit in its own, I think he means there, in their own displacement. So that's my question to you. Is paid content a gamble with the audience's trust? I mean, we know that most North American news media are struggling financially right now. And, you know, your organization famously so, Scott, if I may say so. But is the only way to gain to save independent media, which is what you're setting out to do, is the only way to do that to lose audience trust in what your news organization is? Isn't that a rather leaky lifeboat to place your trust in?
So if we lose audience trust, then we have not done it the right way. And there's no advertiser that wants to lose the trust of their customers. You know, when I started my very first day, and all my old CP friends will laugh, when Lou hired me, I said, I'd like an office with a whiteboard. And I sat there and I wrote the word transparency down in the middle of my whiteboard. And then I wrote three words: publications, advertisers, and audience. And I tried to sort of draw these arrows, like, how are they all connected to transparency? So the audience has to trust our publications, right? And if we're not doing great journalism, they're not going to trust us. Advertisers, and one of the real advantages that we have in doing this, because, by the way, they're all doing it themselves, and if, you know, they all have their own branded content vehicles, their own social campaigns, but one of the things that we have are dependable audiences that are engaged, that are intelligent, that many times are affluent, and also they return. They're loyal readers, which are things that advertisers want. So smart advertisers want to work with credible newsrooms, so you have credibility. And then the one between the advertisers and the public is truth in advertising. So every agency that I've worked with, every brand that I've worked with in the 6 months I've been there, they're actually in favor of transparency. You know, they don't want to fool people. Yes, they want to influence people. They want to sell things. They want to maybe put a point across. But they're not interested in, quote, fooling people. So the premise of that, I think, is wrong. But if we allow that to happen, then we failed.
Okay. Well, I see a question.
Hi, my name is Sandy Naiman. I'm a freelance journalist. And I came down here today because I'm working for a company that is producing branded journalism, and I'm struggling. I'm a traditional journalist, but I've also blogged professionally. I've worked for the Star. I've published in the Globe. And I've been around. And I came here because I wanted some answers. And I'm really confused now because you seem to be struggling with language. I don't care about language. I just want to get the job done. And my concern is that you guys are not concerned about the readers who are, in the future, maybe not using newspapers. They may be using, you know, devices, and they go and search by clicking on a browser, and they don't. And my concern, my problem is that I don't know how to do this, and we're in a paradigm shift right now. PR, two of the young people here who just graduated recently from the University of Western Ontario said that the university is changing towards, it's shifting its towards PR. PR, marketing, and advertising are blending. So my question to you is, as editors who work with people, I hope, and work with journalists, how do we do it if we've been trained in traditional journalism? How do we make the shift? What do we do to make our copy and our job easier?
Interesting.
And I'm
going
to sit down because I want to take notes.
So your job is somebody who produces branded content? Is that the question?
I'm working for a company called Reimagined PR.
Right.
Okay? New company. I'm doing three profiles for a brand new company that just launched in January that produces 3D scanners, affordable ones, so you can actually, for $599, you can scan. You can
this
scan.
Message is brought to you by.
Anyway, I'm trying to do three profiles on people that I have never met, that I've done all the research, and I'm doing it all with email.
I think what I'm hearing here is a question about journalists using the tricks of the trade that they grow up with and are schooled in and have experience in, and and being, if our companies tell great stories, which is what we're saying, how different is this is the work done by journalists for paid content from what they do?
Thank you, by the way, for
Is that right? One of you take that, whichever one of you.
If it's done well, it shouldn't be different. I mean, of course, you're going to get different demands. I don't know what the company is you're working for, or what they're asking for, but done well, as Scott said, basically.
You mean by well? Well, I've got to write for a 31-year-old persona, and I've got to write as if I'm talking to my niece.
Okay, but that's very specific.
That's what I'm saying. You may not think that that's quality content, but I'm saying.
It is quality content.
Okay, sorry.
It can be quality content. You don't understand.
Sandy, why don't we just listen to the answer and move on to the next question? So, yep, go ahead.
Well,
please.
If we apply all the things that we know as journalists, the integrity and the reporting and the storytelling and the narrative, and create a great piece of content, then it shouldn't, like, I'm saying, maintaining quality around this stuff is the only way to ensure, like, that there's a sustainable long-term model here for us. So,
is it, however, a difficulty for the people you're employing to do this kind of paid content work? Are people who have, I take it, spent a lot of time in newsrooms, and is it difficult for them to make the switch in some way? There must be differences, surely, between independent journalism and paid journalism, and, well, it's all paid journalism.
Obviously there's differences because the advertiser gets the final say on it. So it's not journalism, but you can bring journalistic curiosity to the process.
I also think there's something very exciting. So I have a group of people who are mostly, I can see them all sitting back there, who are mostly in their 20s. Some of them are social media strategists, and some of them are journalists with a creative design background, and some of them are journalists with a reporting background, and some of them come straight out of marketing, and some of them are salespeople, and some of them have worked in a mix up of both of them. When this group of people gets into a room and starts to talk about ideas, anything can happen. Like, it's just really interesting what can come out of those kinds of conversations. And it goes back a little bit to the church and state thing. You know, the answers aren't as obvious as they used to be. And I think that we can't really, we'll never see what's coming next, because something's coming next. Maybe it's branded content as a flash in the pan, or paid content, sorry. But we're in a huge mashup right now in the industry we're in. And if we don't keep trying and we don't keep putting ourselves in the forefront of change, we're not going to get to the next thing. We can't stand still, that's for sure. And I do know that far from church and state, when there is a combination of people like the people I work with, they do think in very original ways around telling stories and how to tell them and what makes them interesting.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Madeline White. I'm with the Globe and Mail. Since I'm the only one in line right now, I'm hoping you'll let me ask both questions. My first one is about placement of this content. So far, we've been talking about it appearing in print, in newspapers, as well as on websites. Of course, that's not all of the platforms that news organizations now publish on. Specifically, I'm wondering, my first question is, how do your rules around transparency, differ in terms of publishing on your social media sites? Would you ever consider promoting paid content through your Twitter feeds, if you're on Instagram or on your Facebook page? And my second question is, again, so far we've only talked about the written word, and all three of your companies work in other mediums. I work in the video department in the Globe and Mail, so I'm wondering how your labeling and your transparency has to differ for, like, multimedia journalism, charts, video, etc.
So I can address, right now we do not, nor will we, do any paid content through any of our social media channels, but we are going to set up separate accounts for this to happen. As a matter of fact, I was on the phone today with our chief marketing officer to come up with a strategy on how to do that. So again, it'll be church and state. Newsroom staff aren't going to handle it, but it is an important part of the process.
Yeah, we do that too. So we also do not do any paid content in our Globe social feeds.
Why is that, Jill? Why, and Scott as well, why don't you do that? What's wrong with that?
Because for the same reason that it's controlled by the editorial staff, it's under the editorial brand. Ours will say something.
Okay.
We haven't come up with a name for it yet. We're very close to having that. But then it'll clearly say this is sponsored content, and then we will tweet it out and optimize it, which I think, you know, your point is very well taken. The effectiveness of this is really print, digital, mobile, but it's actually, to get really good at it, you have to send it to certain channels, LinkedIn, Pinterest, all these places, depending on the market that your advertisers want.
And I'm sorry, Jill, I interrupted you.
No, it's fine. Yeah. And we do that all the time as well, separately from our journal editorial channels, that we run social media campaigns for, again, I say we, but the advertising side run social media campaigns for clients. Mobile's an interesting one. We do have our native content on mobile, and it's labeled exactly the same way that it is on our site and all the same conventions. But I mean, mobile's interesting. We have, you know, almost 50% of our traffic comes from mobile now, which is pretty common across the industry. And yet, of course, nobody has figured out how to monetize mobile in any way. And it's part of the whole crisis, besides the fact that in the last 10 years, the Canadian newspaper industry has lost $1 billion in print advertising. And the fact that banner ads, which John Oliver referred to a little bit, are sort of a thing of the past. It's almost like a legacy ad unit for us now. Everybody's buying audience shares and programmatic and all this kind of thing. So this is why this is one way, this is one area for us that's growing, for everybody, I think, in terms of percentage of our revenue. It's a huge chunk. But also on mobile, display ads, of course, don't work on mobile advertising. When I say mobile, I mean smartphones. The iPad and the tablets is a totally different thing. So this is one way for us to actually sell advertising in that environment that works, because no one's been able to make that work. So, you know, but we label it the same way. Does that answer both questions? I can't remember what the other one was.
How we do it in video. So it'll be the same labels in all. To be honest with you, we haven't fully come up with our protocol on video, but it will follow the same. One of the things when we redid our labeling guidelines was they are exactly the same, whether it's print or digital or mobile.
Hi, and
whatever this question is, it's going to you, Catherine.
Oh,
are we hogging that?
Well, she works
for
me.
Catherine, so that's fine. That works for me. I'm Rosemary Westwood. I'm wondering what the saturation point is for all of this. I know my boss's dream is for not enough time to complete all of the work for clients that we have, and to have our doors being broken down with people who want us to do that kind of work. And I'm kind of wondering at what point. Is it too much? Have you thought about that? Do you have a ratio kind of in place that you know you're not going to cross this limit? Does it apply to one particular kind of paid content, or is it seen as an amalgamation, one force against the other, which is your independent reporting? So what are you thinking about in terms of at what point it's too much?
Gosh, I would love to be in a position of saying it's too much. Stop with the advertising dollars. No more. No, that's a good question, and I think because we have not really been in the land of plenty, and I have had times when we have been. I have had times when you're like, no, we can't take that ad, we're full. But we haven't been in that for quite a while. So, but we may be again, and we probably should think seriously about, what the saturation point is. What's the tipping point in a true journalistic enterprise between the two? Have you guys set limits?
We also haven't had that problem yet. But no, it's a very, very good question. We've just done our first native campaign. We're at the very beginning of this. So if they start to roll in, I think that maybe that will be a question. I mean, we remember the days, and there was, well, I guess there is now, but there was always a ratio in the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, you would, if you got too many ads, the size of the paper would go up so that there was enough editorial to, so It's a great question. I don't actually have an answer right now.
And the reason, Jill, it seems to me, we have these ratios that we've all been brought up with in our generation of news managers, is that we presume that, you know, yes, when advertising was infinite, seemingly, that if you went above a certain ratio, it would change the character of what you were doing, that readers would begin to think of your product in a different way.
Did you say you worked at a women's magazine?
I did. And believe it or not, we had a ratio. I can even remember the number. Now, but I mean, the reason why this question is so interesting to me is that isn't that exact same problem present now if the average read, if it is true that New York Times browsers, audiences are clicking and spending more time on paid content than news content, is it not true that we are in fact closer than you guys think to the point where the character of your product is changing?
I think the bigger thing to worry about is not so much the ratio, because it's a different type of ratio, is as everybody jumps on the latest bandwagon that's going to save the industry, and this is, in my opinion, not something that's going to help bring in new revenue. There's never going to be a giant savior of the industry. We all have to be, imagine, we do this thing at Post Media called the Labs, you know, which I actually think is an imaginative and a way to bring in new revenue and connect to communities as anything that anybody's doing. But my concern is like, if you can remember banner ads 15 years ago, they were great, and now everyone is blind to them, and he's right, 0.18% of people click on them. And if we do too much of this stuff, people will become blind. Also, we're putting this, in many cases, in very valuable places, and it should be a premium product, and if we can't sell it as a premium product, then it becomes a commodity, and then we're just in the same problem. Finally, the point about how much is the guy, we're having discussions about this as we're expanding this across the Post Media Network and all of the platforms, and the person who's going to make that decision is Lou Clancy, who's the head of all of the editorial department. He's going to make the call on how much is too much.
So, Lou Clancy, how much is too much then?
Women's magazine's
got to
go.
Please.
Hi, I'm Rita Tritcher, and I'm a reporter. I'm now with the Wall Street Journal, but I've worked for some of you. You know, I don't pretend to have any vision as to where the industry is going or what the solution ought to be. But I have to tell you, as a reporter, when I hear the suggestion that there might be a deterioration between the lines of church and state, it really does make my stomach turn. And it's hurtful to hear that, because what we do is so important. And the reason that people talk to us is because we have integrity. I had a source tell me that the other day. You know, I talk to you because you have integrity. That's why I tell you things. So I just wanted to ask you all, in this age of having a paywall, have you considered what kind of damage this could potentially do to the paywall model if readers don't trust you? You have to give them a reason to come to your newspaper. And the reason they come is because you give them scoops. And so, you know, this seems to be a completely different thing. And I just worry, you know, everybody's gone to a paywall. I work for an organization that has a paywall as well. But shouldn't that be the priority right now?
I just want to talk a bit about the destruction of church and state, yeah, because I'm worried that I perhaps gave the impression that that didn't exist, or that there wasn't genuine, real journalism happening in an organization that also does branded content or paid content. And at the Toronto Star, and I think at all of our organizations, at the Toronto Star, they do massive journalistic investigations. The commercial content is not handled by any of the newsroom journalists. It was the decision made very early on that those enterprises would be divided. Journalists in the Star are not asked to write commercial content. And if it means, you know, I was talking to Michael Cook the other day, and he reminded me of a series that the Star did on Bell Canada couple years ago. It cost the Star $4 million, and if Michael said if he had to do it again, he'd do it again. So I think what I meant to say about that is that you can have that unfettered by outside interest journalistic belief and drive in your organization at the same time that you can also be exploring things like paid content and bringing in more revenue dollars, and the one doesn't besmirch the other.
As long as, I suppose, it's labeled properly and the readers actually do know what's going on. I think the concern is that they don't know, and it reflects badly on others in the organization. I mean, as a reporter, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and wonder, oh my God, have I been fair to this person, right? So I'm just saying, are we being fair to the readers when we don't label properly?
That's a good question, right? How much do readers notice? How much do they actually, how much are they aware of the difference between paid content and independent content?
I mean, I think readers are smart. I know Oliver made fun of it. I think readers are smart and can tell the difference and can understand labeling. Although in the readings that you shared with us, there was one piece that did a long study on framing. I don't know if you guys read it, but the gist of it was that if a story that is commercial content is framed within a legitimate journalistic enterprise, people tend to imbue it with the same principles as the overall journalistic enterprise. So, you know, I think we're all aware of that, and I think that's the core of why this kind of advertising has captured the interest of advertisers, because it adds a sheen to their message they're trying to get out.
Actually, when Oliver made reference to that study by the Interactive Advertising Bureau, there was actually, and this is the thing I found really interesting, is that they did a survey on, and it was a sample size, and it was almost like a lab project about paid content in the business sections, in the entertainment section, and the general news section. And I found this the most interesting, is that in business, 82% said the content was clearly paid for by a brand, so they showed them examples. People reading entertainment news, it was 85%. In general news, it was 41%. Hmm. So the readers of that formed their own perception. And I went away and I thought about this, and, you know, Rita, you would know this as well as anyone. People who, you know, if you're in the business, you're really interested in business news, you are more than likely already going to the website of a company to find out about information yourself. So you're, I think, used to living in that world already. And in entertainment, I think it's the same thing, because entertainment was really the first to do its own style of branded content. So I think they're feeling more comfortable about it. And interesting enough, only 41%, you know, sort of felt that it was clearly labeled in the news section, even though the labels were exactly the same. So I think that, you know, that's something that all of us need to think about.
Yeah, I remember, you know, we were laughing about my women's magazine history. I think that's rather sexist of you. But
no.
I mean, we invented editorials, you know. But I know that we did the research, and it was really disturbing to me that in fact our readers did not notice the difference between clearly labeled advertising and editorial content when it came to fashion or beauty or, you know, kitchens and blah, blah, blah. You know, they probably knew the difference between a profile of the Prime Minister, Kim Campbell, and an advertisement for lipstick. But, you know, it was disturbing to see how little they understood about the independence of the journalistic content.
Hi, Susan Krasinski. I'm with the Globe and Mail. A few months ago, Polar Mobile, which is a Canadian company that does a lot of work helping publishers with native advertising content, they pulled together click-through rates on native ads in Canada. And while native ads performed much, much better than banner ads, they were still less than 0.3% on average. Now, granted, that is pulled down by the poorer performers in native advertising, and that same company has said that when it's done well, it's significantly higher. But what I'd like to know is what you're seeing so far in terms of your click-through rates on some of the native or paid-for content that you produce. And the reason I ask that is I'm curious whether it's high enough that this content will continue to be attractive to advertisers once it's no longer novel, once it is potentially a little bit more commoditized, especially since many see this as a bit of an ethical compromise for our industry. Is the revenue promise there enough for native advertising to be the savior that it's often positioned as?
So I think one
I think Jill was...
I just think one of the problems is by measuring native content on a click-through rate, I think is missing the point of what the native content should be. And I talk to agencies and read a lot about marketers, and they're all struggling with what is their measure of success. So quite often, a click-through rate isn't the best way to measure it. And you know, financially, then we're going to be talking about CPMs, and we all know where that leads.
Yeah.
So I'm to answer your question, our rates are about the same as what the Polar showed in terms of versus the regular banner ads.
We don't have a lot to go on yet, so we've only done one campaign in the engagement again. So we don't just look at clicks anymore. We look at engagement, time spent, when people go back. And I don't have the exact numbers, but it was definitely comparable to some things we do in editorial. Of course, there's a whole range of how engaged people are with different types of content on our site. But promising, you know, there are some news organizations that have claimed extremely high rates, but they have different kinds of content, different kinds of audiences. So I think a news audience is very specific, and it's a little bit different from a BuzzFeed audience or an Onion or a Gawker. To answer your question about whether or not this is worth it to save the industry, I don't think any of us know that. Catherine's right, it may, you know, there may be a next thing, but right now, I would say if you look at a graph of all our different lines of advertising, including digital advertising as we've known it thus far and how fast it's growing, it's pretty flat. And if you look at the collective group of all the types of paid content we're talking about and also programmatic, although programmatic's a decreased CPM and native's a premium product, those are going like straight up. So we're projecting a 14% growth year over year in native, and we can't say that for too many of our other advertising lines of revenue. So I don't know long term, but for now it seems to be have a certain amount of momentum and potential for us.
So CPM is clicks per thousand, is that right? But what is programmatic?
Programmatic is, so instead of buying a certain number of impressions on the Globe and Mail site, somebody wants a certain amount of impressions for a certain demographic with a certain income or at least a certain audience makeup. So they might, they have these groupings or alliances of different publications, and instead of buying on one specific publication, you're just buying, I don't care where it turns up as long as I'm reaching that particular audience. So it's very, computer sort of monitored people, it's confusing. But the point is it's driving the rates down and people are less interested in your brand specifically, and it's more of a broader audience play, whereas native's kind of the opposite. They're actually trying to embed themselves and be associated with your brand, which has a much, much higher value.
Which brings us to an interesting question that's coming from Twitter, if I may, Bob, interject that. A Twitter question from someone many of us know, Belinda Elsner. Hello, Belinda, former associate editor of JSource. How will newspapers, she wants to know, compete for brand content dollars once brands figure out publishing an audience on their own?
Well, they already are.
Yeah, they already are.
they're, you know, I mean, everything that was once a pipeline is now a publishing house, from Amazon to Netflix to, you know, you name it. YouTube, everybody is figuring out how to be their own publisher. So it's a huge challenge. And I think what we offer, going back to what we were talking about earlier, is that we know content and journalism style storytelling better than anyone. We know how to galvanize readers. We know how to get people to feel an urgency around a story and get them excited and take action. And so, with all of those skills in our pocket, we you know, can sometimes convince brands that they won't do as well on their own. And honestly, if you go around to agencies, not to insult any agencies, but people, when they talk about content, it's almost like, give me some of that, like pass the salt. I need some content in this. But there isn't really a sense of what that means. And so I think the kind of thing that we're all doing is when we talk about content, we know what we mean, and we're doing serious work.
And I would also add to that, which I think Scott said at the beginning, our audience. So we have an audience. So a brand may produce, they may get to spend 10 times as much money as we can on producing something, but they don't have that devoted audience that comes back again and again and again. There's some brands that, you know, like Target, who's doing really aggressive social media stuff and all kinds of content marketing, and so maybe they're getting lift, I don't know, but most of the things that I sort of read about this is that they have those ideas, they have that, but they still need the audience, so that's the other piece of the content and audience, I guess. That's not to say they're not nipping at our heels and that may change, because it might.
I think it also gives us an opportunity to do more sophisticated things. So the Netflix one, which was, I think, one of the things that I thought was the best ever, because Netflix, the New York Times wrote about a really serious issue. You know, the series is about women in prison, and they wrote a very serious story about women in prison. The other one that I've been most impressed about was one that was done in the States between Ford and AOL, and it was called This Built America. And they went around and profiled in every state in the U.S. Small manufacturing companies that are trying to bring back that sort of same ethos that Ford believes in. And some great storytelling, right? And so, yes, Ford was advertising in it, but Ford was also trying to, you know, lift its brand, and probably honestly believed in it that, you know, small manufacturing needs to come back to make this country better. So I think there is an opportunity there to, you know, if this stuff is strictly promotional, I think it doesn't fit well in what we do. If it's more intelligent, if it leads to thought leadership, fully labeled, people make up their own mind, I think there's a real opportunity here.
Hi, Bob Lewis. I'm a freelance journalist. And when Brother Shapiro was doing his thing at Chatelaine, I had the duty of putting out a small weekly in the building called McLean's. And I have a couple of questions, but I just wanted to second what he just said, that we're absolutely fooling ourselves if we think people don't know the difference between, if we're fooling ourselves if we think that they really notice the labeling. And as Jill said, it's all over the lot. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us what labels you actually use for the various things, because I'm confused myself. I see all kinds of things like special information supplement, and it goes on and on. So that's the first question to each of you. What are the labels for each of the three genres we're talking about tonight? And secondly, do you not worry that this trend we're seeing in our business is costing us a lot of great opportunities for good journalism? We see bureaus being cut. We see institutions that no longer have people in Ottawa or even at Queen's Park or in provincial capitals. We see, I think, a couple of people out in covering the Ebola epidemic, only two, I think, that I can think of. Maybe there are more. There should be a lot more Canadians over there. So do you worry about this trend that while we're pandering to people who want good news or safe environments, and you're right, Scott, there have been some great stories, and the Globe had a great one, I think, on the Arctic, which was that not also native content?
No, and that
I was surprised you didn't mention that.
Do you want to finish your question, or was
yeah?
That...
And so the question is, and I'm rambling. The question is, do you not fear for kind of serious investigative journalism at the cost of pandering to people who want safe environments?
Well, I'll start with the native, with the Arctic question, because there was a lot of confusion around that, and I think it brings back to the church and state, which has come up a couple of times here. And I would say we still completely have church and state in the sense that nobody in our newsroom works on paid advertiser content. But in the ways that I would say the church and state is a little bit different than it used to be in a positive way, we have a much more reciprocal, respectful, and communicated relationship with the people in our sales department. And as journalists, we feel like one of the greatest ways that we can, you know, control this, or at least have as much journalistic input as possible into the content that advertisers want, is to bring our newsroom ideas to the sales floor. So we do that all the time, and that's what happened with North. That was not, they didn't come to us and say, can you do something on the North? We had this newsroom project that we really wanted to do, and it's very, very expensive to go up to the North, and it costs newsrooms the kind of money that most of us don't have kicking around these days. And so our news editors and a few other of our reporters came up with this plan, and we took it to our partner, people in sales that we work with, and said, find us a sponsor for this, and then maybe the advertising department, because they want the sponsorship, can help us fund this thing a little bit. So it actually worked the other way around, and we've done a lot of those. Which isn't, that's not always how it happens, but I think that there's a real opportunity there for us to stop being afraid of sales and actually work with them to bring our journalism to them and help them sell it. So we do that. In terms of the bureaus closing, I mean, I'll let you guys speak to that too. It's, none of us feel good about that, but I don't think it's the cause effect is quite correct there, because it's not that we're, you know, shutting bureaus and laying off journalists. The New York Times laid off 100 more people this week, as I'm sure you all read, and it's happening to our colleagues all over the continent. That's not because of this content. I think, as Catherine's trying to say, this coexists over here in order to kind of keep us, our heads above water in this fairly, scary environment from an economic point of view.
I mean, Bob, I actually see it completely the opposite. We want to keep doing this stuff. We want to have investigative, and you need revenue to do it. And there's a wall between these two, and there's no client that I'm working with on this side that's ever going to say, hey, we don't like it. Or if they do, we say, okay, that's fine. You have your opinion. It's not going to affect what we do. But if, you know, no buck Rogers, right? And it's really what we, you know, so I specifically got into this because I am worried about the business model, as I said.
But when you say that we're kidding ourselves if we think that people grasp that some of it is paid content, some of it is journalism, and despite our best efforts to label, and studies seem to support that that's true, I think another question that we have to ask ourselves that's slightly different but along the same lines is, how much do people care? And the answer to that question is very frightening to anyone in journalism. How much do people care that it's brought to you by General Electric versus the integrity of a news operation? And I think that the responsibility of all of us with journalism at our back is to make sure that our readers and our advertisers understand what journalism is. I think we're spending a lot of time worrying about how we're labeling the commercial part properly, but maybe what we should be doing is really saying, and you know, this is part of the job of the front page, exclusive scoop, nobody else has it, it's ours, we worked on it, like make sure that audiences know what goes into journalism and how that distinguishes it from labeled content.
And do you want me to just answer your first question? I can do that
very quickly.
We do have many different ways that we label it. We acknowledge that that's been confusing. And on our new standards, we came up in the special information feature, and all those things have now gone out the window. So this is literally very, very recent, and we'll have this in place probably even by next week. But we just decided to call everything sponsored content. So it's consistent. Mm. It looks the same on our digital platforms or in our paper, and people know exactly what it is.
So it's like paid posts at the New York
Times. Yeah, the New York Times. Yeah. So we already do that online, but now we're going to revise the newspaper labeling. And there's also a little disclaimer, not disclaimer, but a little information box that we run now, but it's a little bit small. So we've decided to make that more prominent and more clear, that says how it was created and that it wasn't editorial.
Sorry, I think, Bob, I know they're important, but I also see a line.
I brought ours with it, it'd take me half an hour to read them all out, but I'm happy to talk to anybody afterwards and show you what we do.
please.
My name is Sabah Kwao. I run a startup called Newsrooms. We live and breathe branded content and social media marketing. And we're 2 years old, and I'd say we have about 12 or 13 of Canada's best companies as clients. It was disappointing to sit and listen to all of you describe solutions that are relatively similar to each other. And from a strategy point of view, it means you've presented undifferentiated solutions and you haven't overcome the commodification of your business. It's unfortunate because you have great brands and you have an opportunity and you have an audience of companies who are truly looking for innovation in digital marketing to reach your audiences. So what I would ask you is, do any of you have anything disruptive in your innovation? Anything that's actually a head turner that an advertiser or a marketer is going to say, you know what, I want that and I'm willing to pay a premium, because right now I could go to you, you, and you, and you'd give me all kind of the same thing. You've ended up offering a commodity rather than an innovation.
Good question. Do you have one and can I have it?
You can buy.
Are you selling
company.
Us your services?
But,
I want you.
But that's why the clients are coming. But we hear the problem literally every day. And we obsess on your industry because all my staff are from Globe and Mail, CTV, CBC. We ambulance chase. Every time you lay off, we sort of go down a list and say, who do we want? Because you have great resources, but you're not offering a new solution. So I'd love to hear your innovation.
Well, can you give us an example of something disruptive that you have done?
Sure. We have a Twitter account called Travel Newsroom, and we used it to create travel content for a brand that was marketing a credit card. Travel Newsroom, in 3 months, had the same reach and influence as the Globe and Mail Travel Twitter account, which means that for the 20 years that you've built a brand, in 3 months, we were able to use that account to reach audiences and draw them to sign up for a credit card. That's an innovation that took 3 months and probably a hundredth of the cost of you running your business. So that's what I would call a dramatic innovation in the category that an advertiser wants to pay for. So I want to hear if any of you have any head-turning innovations that we would actually make us go, wow.
I'm not sure that I'm hearing what's head-turning in that, except for you did a really good job running a social campaign, and we've got lots of examples of sort of campaigns that we've done that have been successful. I will say it is new. Some of this, the really cool and interesting stuff is new territory, and you look at some of the things like the New York Times, and they've thrown all their multimedia digital experts at this, and so we're looking at that right now. We're trying to say, like, instead of just providing content in this one certain kind of way, why don't we try and look at some of the most interesting things we've done with our multimedia team and see how we can apply that to this content. We haven't actually done that yet, but we just had a conversation about that today. And so we are thinking that way. We are like thinking of social strategies that will help. And we're refining, revising, and iterating on this stuff kind of every day.
We
don't have a deer kitten though yet. Yeah, so I don't know if everyone's seen that, but.
I mentioned earlier, I think one of the most innovative things that we do is Post Media Labs, which Duncan Clark runs, and I work very closely with Duncan. Many of you may know it as GastroPost. We have a labs project in Alberta called Capital Ideas, where the whole concept of the labs is that there's passions and enthusiasms that exist out there. You allow people to become experts in the field that they're passionate about, and then there is a way to commercialize them. So, for instance, GastroPost is just about everybody loving food, and they do a mission every week. The thing that's completely stunned me when I first met Duncan a couple of years ago, I wasn't even working at Post Media, was the demographics of GastroPost is women 25 to 40, almost exclusively women, not. And a lot of those people would never pick up a print newspaper. But the thing they like most about GastroPost is that on Saturday, the National Post runs double truck thing that puts them in the paper. And I've been to the events that GastroPost does, and it's that validation of being in print, which like counterintuitive. So that's great. But the other thing that they do is they also, the labs does embed labs. So for instance, what you now have is you have this this group of people who are enthusiastic about different subject matters. Now we have sponsors coming to us and say, we call it an embed lab, is like, we actually want to do a very focus group. And so they pay us to do that. And it's fantastic. And I think it's a, you know, it's really innovative, totally transparent. And the people love being empowered by us. And so it's a great fit.
Thank you. I think we have now 4 minutes to go before Kathy or Natalie puts the chop on us or whatever it's called. Let me ask you a question, all of you, and then ask you all to incorporate whatever closing thoughts you have into your answer. And it'll pick up.
There are three more people waiting to ask questions.
I am sorry. Okay, you know what? I didn't know that because I couldn't see around the pillar. How about a very quick question from the first person, and then ask the other two people who are waiting to please forgive us because we've run out of time.
Okay. I'll be brief, I promise. Yeah,
thank you.
My question is simply related to brands. I should say I'm Ali Morrow. I've worked as a freelance journalist. I've also worked as a marketing strategist. Yeah. Related to brands, we've been discussing them as all equal effectively, and I think the pain point with respect to this kind of content tends to be the meshing, and Scott, you referenced this at the beginning, related to Atlantic and Scientology. Bit awkward, no one was a big fan of that. BMO and this event, everyone seems to be pretty comfortable. So with respect to brands and where they can fit within your papers, shell, energy section of a business section, is that okay? How have you been making those decisions?
Okay, you know what I'm going to suggest? Because I do see three very interesting people, including that very interesting question. I'm going to suggest we hear all three questions,
yep.
And you guys incorporate your closing thoughts into answering all of them.
Good.
So I see Teresa.
Hi there. I'm Teresa Evden. I work in PR now, but I was a journalist for 12 years. And I have a question for you around category exclusivity. So we've all talked about your terms in terms of when you have your advertisers come and do custom content arrangements with you. Full disclosure, I don't do any right now, but I'm here and I'm interested. But if one of my competitors comes to you and says, I'm going to sponsor a series, it's going to be on digital, and here's a list, officially or unofficially, of the companies we don't want you to quote in the stories around the ad. Has this ever happened to you, and how did you respond if it did, or how would you respond?
Okay, and number three.
Hi, I'm Ed Greenspan, and first off, for those of you who were a little hard on my friends up there because of what they do and it sort of not supporting real journalism or whatever, you know, real journalism doesn't exist without business models, and these guys are groping for business models, which is a good thing. Unfortunately, I think we're groping in the wrong place, which comes to my question. You know, and it comes to the point I think Catherine made a few minutes ago, which she'll be happy to know I agree with. You know, what we need to do is we need to sharpen our brands and what they're about, and we need to really concentrate on what we're good at in a content way. You know, we're going to lose advertising. We're losing advertising. If we lose what the brand promise is, which is some people have said, which is about good, serious, hard-hitting news at the end of the day, that's the only place where we can where we have a comparative advantage. We no longer have a comparative advantage in lifestyles. People have talked about that. Brands can do that as well as we can do that. Indeed, I was having dinner with a friend who became diabetic. I said, where'd you get your information? He said, from the Kraft site. Go figure. But you know, he's a very sophisticated guy. But I think the Kraft site is actually better than us at giving him that kind of information. So my question is, when do we get real and begin to, and you know, there's all kinds of categories that we're being stripped from. Newspapers are going to have trouble in sports because they have trouble competing for the best sports journalists because networks can offer so much more. Lifestyles is a problem. Financial advice might become a problem as banks might offer better financial advice, although hopefully they'll be suspect on that. But if they stand back, they can do a job as well as we can do. So when do we get serious about what we're really good at, which is iterative, journalism day after day, where you go after the story and you build on it and you're patient and get our consumers, not our advertisers, but our consumers, to have a kind of relationship where they'll pay real money for that.
Okay. I've learned the hard way that it's a mistake to upset Natalie, so I'm going to ask you guys to really be brief.
Should we each pick to answer one question?
Great idea. Great idea.
I'll answer Teresa's question. So if this was, under our definition, directed editorial, I guess custom content under yours, it's a non-starter. Right? If we're doing what we would call sponsored content or what we call promoted content, they get control. They can tell us who to quote or not to quote. One of the things I'm trying to do is to get them to say, you know, the better stories are probably the ones where you're not mentioned, you know, and especially in the financial area. We just did a thing with Manulife Financial where they weren't mentioned at all in it. They were interested in raising awareness about their foreign mutual funds. So I hired a former CP colleague of mine, Julian Beltram, our former economics writer, and he wrote about emerging markets, and they gave us guidance, and they got to look at it, and honestly, the only changes they made were actually copy editing changes, which was amazing to me. So, but if it's the, you know, the stuff where the editorial, we would never allow anybody to tell us who we can and who we couldn't.
Yeah, we don't do that either, just to second that. Well, there was a bunch of different themes that came up in those two questions, but you know, I would argue that we haven't stopped doing hard-hitting journalism. If you can just look in our publications every single day, we're still doing that. We're hiring people. We're expanding in certain parts of the country that are important to us. Integrity has never stopped being the number one concern. We know that we need to be a source for our readers where they can come and trust us for the kind of content that we're going to deliver, and that really hasn't changed. I don't think that's affected by this. I just think that, as we've mentioned a whole bunch of times tonight, you know, we do need to find a way to pay for that, and we need to navigate. All these things are good questions. Like, they're good questions to ask. They're good conversations to be having. I think it's a growing, changing landscape all the time, and we're trying to navigate it. I think, again, I'll just repeat what I've said. The onus is on us to create good content that has value and that is not, and that is clearly labeled, and not to trick anybody, and, you know, do the best that we can working within the environment that we're in right now to bring some of those values, some of that talent, some of that thinking, some of that creative idea generation that we're so good at, and, you know, create content that's at least, you know, we can feel okay about it, and in order to let us do all those other things that we want to do.
Catherine?
Well, I'll take Ed's gauntlet, and I agree with Jill. I think that, you know, we are doing it. We are doing serious journalism. All media organizations take it very seriously. The Star has Atkinson principles, which everyone who works there believes in and follows. What I don't think we're doing, and this is something I'd want to do for a while, is as an industry, branding ourselves in a way that will help people understand why it's important that we exist. So, you know, at its simplest level, like the milk campaign transformed the way everybody thought about milk, and people started to make sure they drank milk again, and milk's important, and I feel that as an industry, we haven't done that about ourselves. It has happened in the past, but we haven't done it for a long time, and I think especially for the younger generation, the kids who, you know, didn't have five papers around them every day when they got up from that their parents were reading, that we need to, and when they've got so many choices of the kinds of information coming at them on the different devices that are coming at them through, that was not grammatical, we need to get serious telling people what it is that we're serious about. Ed shaking his head at me.
Thank you. This entire evening has been brought to you by Natalie Turvey, Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, who has the final word.
Our panel for sharing their insights, answering the tough questions, and talking about the best standards and practices for native content. And Ivor, our outstanding moderator, our thanks to you for making the work you put into making this a timely and substantive discussion. Please join me in a round of appreciation for our speakers. I'd also like to thank BMO Financial Group, our sponsor this evening, for their ongoing support of CJFJ Talks, and our thanks to in-kind supporters, The Globe and Mail, CPAC, and CNW for supporting this evening's event. Coming up this fall, on October 21st, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, best known for his fearless reporting on Edward Snowden and U.S. state surveillance. He joins David Walmsley, editor-in-chief of The Globe and Mail, for a talk on power and privacy in an era of digital openness. On November 17th, we're joined by Mashable's executive editor, Jim Roberts. Roberts is a New York Times veteran and former editor-in-chief of nytimes.com. He joins the Globe's media reporter, James Bradshaw, for a talk on digital transformation and Mashable's ambitions to deepen its news content. And November 27th, we're talking Twitter with Steve Ladurante, head of news and government partnerships. He'll be in conversation with Post Media's Duncan Clark on Twitter's new tools and what they will mean to journalists across the country. So I hope you'll join us for these events, and I thank you for being here tonight with us and supporting the work of the CJF, and invite you to stay, chat with our panelists, and join us for cocktails and conversation at the back of the room. Thanks.